So are we all sitting comfortably? Are we all set and ready to take part in week five's little lecture? He says, with perhaps just a hint of, perhaps patronism? No, patriarchy. Well, definitely, if we'd been sitting here in 1888 or the 1890s, or indeed the 1870s or the 1860s, the likelihood is we would not have had a single woman amongst us at all. In fact, we wouldn't. Quite simply, women didn't go off to university and do such things. It was not seemed appropriate for young ladies to engage in such matters. And if you had got any level of education, it was primarily to actually look after the family or social engagements and so on. If you want to have a general snapshot of that, look at any of the Bronte sisters' writings, Jane Eyre, and so on and so forth. And that melodrama, that element, the role of women in society, is something which has really emerged to the fore in Victorian England and Victorian Britain. You might say, ironically, as Queen Victoria was clearly on the throne, but was she the power? Was it Prince Albert? Were there all sorts of other issues at work there? Nevertheless, we'd certainly shifted in Britain as a country into a nation that was very much seen as a patriarchy and remained pretty much so until arguably the middle to the latter part of the 20th century. Some might even say, even in certain areas up until now, given the piece that I conducted this morning with the Royal Institute for Chartered Surveyors, suggested they're trying to also embrace a diverse policy of having more women chartered surveyors and so on. The image I've actually put up for you on screen there, and that's available on slides, is a very melodramatic image that is really best entitled The Fallen Woman. A young lady has given birth to a child out of wedlock, and she is banished into the darkness. The warm of the Victorian household with the family there in despair, quite literally, because their sister, their daughter, has committed the cardinal sin of having a child out of wedlock. And that also brings to it huge areas relating to sexuality and the attitude that was present within the Victorian era relating to sexuality, and also the hypocrisy that related to that. Because when we start talking about new journalism, which is ultimately what today's talk is going to be focused on, it has its roots in Victorian prejudice. Not just pride and prejudice, but in prejudice. Prejudgments, decisions that are made on the basis of assumptions and lines that are taken from those particular perspectives. Attitudes relating to women. Fears about the poor. What do we do with this great multitude of hungry workers, poor people living in poverty, living in conditions that are hardly sanitary? How can we as a great nation solve those issues? Things which we actually looked at in the first week with respect to agitating for change and so on. But in this particular instance, together with the ongoing Industrial Revolution, very much at the heart of issues that, as we will see, impacted on Victorian journalism at the time. If you were seen as being poor, you were in some sense uncivilized. At this time, the church is dominant, the Church of England in particular. It's a ruling, clear body that effectively, together with Parliament, impacts on our cultural beliefs and so on. And also there is this notion of self-improvement. Ultimately, if you are in a difficult situation, you must move out of it yourself. You cannot rely on state intervention to help you or support you and so on. If you're also poor, you might well be uncivilized. You might also turn to crime. You might steal food. You might steal other things. It could be a slippery slope which leads you down to the notion of becoming a criminal. And if you can't understand the new people who are appearing on the streets, people who might be Irish, people who might be Italian, people who don't even speak the Queen's English, and people who are Jewish, inevitably there's a concern, there's a fear. And what I'll show you over the next 40 minutes or so is how unscrupulous journalists could use that fear to sell huge amounts of newspapers. Journalists at the time, not all admittedly, and it's worth noting that this is not a universal aspect, this is just some key points that I'm drawing your attention to, they would make use of these prejudices and fears primarily to sell newspapers. And the type of stories that the journalists would actually use to sell newspapers are characterized primarily as being moral panic stories. The moral majority, the great sort of view of the perspective, the people who are right, the righteous folks, etc. So let's talk a little bit about moral panic. Let's begin to sort of address a 6 points line in terms of how you can, in the year 2016, create a story which is guaranteed to create a sense of moral panic. I'll let you fill in the blanks, but I'll actually sort of give you the steps. Step one, identify the behavior of a particular group which is bad for everyone else. That group could be hoodies. It could be violent youths. It could be foreigners. It could be any group you choose. It could be Star Trek fans. You know, but there's something strange about them. Those strange ways and the way in which they have their strange idic signs and infinite diversity lines. There's something peculiar about the ears that they might wear and so on. Potentially could go to, what happens if they're going to the Pon Fa? Good grief. In other words, what you're then doing for step two is creating a division between them, the Star Trek fans wearing hoodies, nightmare, but them and us, the normal people. The people who effectively carry on our, or are trying to carry on our everyday life and existence. So you establish a clear division. Then you get a consensus. You establish a consensus in which there is a widespread acceptance that there's some kind of threat that's actually here. Somehow they're taking our jobs, they're taking our women, taking, you know, there's something which, if it wasn't here, if it wasn't for the students in Lincoln, why I ought to, you know, a whole range of sort of issues relating to that sort of element. But there's a simple message there, a very simple message, that somehow these strangers, these foreigners, who are not us, are impacting on us as human beings. Fourthly, you exaggerate. You distort the evidence. You exaggerate the scale of the threat. You find stories that can really impact and lend credence to this belief that you've put into the public sphere. And then you will demand, through your newspaper columns, that the authorities or somebody does something. Something must be done. We can't let this situation go on. If we carry on like this, we won't have a country left to live in. Finally, the panic is short-lived. It's difficult to sustain that level of hatred, but it's that kind of area that really impacts in terms of what we're referring to. This being a classic example, the Contagious Diseases Act of 1864 and 1867, where women who happened to be prostitutes were seen as unclean and a blight on society. Sexuality and Victorian times went together like bread and cheese, cheese and what, a whole range of things. I mean, effectively, there were a whole range of concerns about sexuality that, again, were perpetrated throughout the whole culture. There was a general idea that men, in general, were naturally polygamous. It's the sowing of the seeds. It's important, you know, if you're a man, you've got to, you know, have a whole range of sort of conquests and so on. But good women were monogamous. Good women were monogamous. So you can see the disconnection there straight away from the notion of if you've got a society which believes, well, men are naturally polygamous, whereas women, if they're good, are monogamous, there's a disconnect. Good men, again, primarily were seen as patriarchs who could control themselves. And normally we'd have the restraint to actually control ourselves. But If they couldn't, it wasn't their fault. Anxieties were projected onto women. In other words, you get a general acceptance that good men are tempted by bad women. Okay? If a woman, as we saw in the opening slide there, the opening image, if a woman had a child out of wedlock, she was seen as a fallen woman. Babies would be left in foundling hospitals at best, or infanticide was rife. You would literally have to kill the child, kill the baby. It was seen as shameful. Society would turn a blind eye. We just don't discuss that sort of thing in polite society. These things don't happen. Now again, primarily, there is an argument that suggests most people were actually fairly normal, as we are now, but they were ignorant and they were embarrassed. There was an awful lot of misinformation about sexuality. There's an awful lot of sexual repression. There's an awful lot of areas where people, we don't talk about that, it's not polite, etc. And what happens when you suppress something? Well, you automatically create a market for it. And the two major outlets that occurred in Victorian times were pornography and prostitution. You also had a range of incest taking place, masters and servants, domination, a whole range of other factors, but I won't go into that. You can research it in your own time. Primarily, prostitution generated a moral panic which reached its height in the 1850s to the 1860s. Why? Why did we actually have what is generally agreed to be the oldest profession in the world, ever since Eve was dealing with apples and Adam, etc.? Why did you actually have it relate to this particular time of civilization and British culture? Well, for women, prostitution was one route to economic and personal independence. In other words, it was a means of survival. If you had moved from the country into towns, into the cities and so on, where there could well be chronic unemployment, the streets would not be paved with gold, there weren't any factories in London, London didn't actually make anything. It was a big centre, but it's not a manufacturing place like Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds and so on. So you head down to London where the streets might be paved with gold, and actually they're not. How do you actually survive? You have got a ready market because there's a vast population of town slum dwellers, soldiers, sailors, dock workers, and immigrants, all looking for that, you know, moment or whatever, etc. But again, relating to that whole process. Clearly, the establishment of time were concerned, and there were a series of sustained campaign sermons which spoke against prostitution, that actually pointed out that it was a depraved and dangerous element in society. That these were all fallen women, that they were a threat not only to the Victorian family life, but they were a threat ultimately to decent society. Something had to be done, and something was done. The Contagious Diseases Act of 1864 was brought in, revamped in 1867. And what did this actually provide for people to actually do? Provide men to actually do if they so choose? If you thought a woman might be a prostitute, you could effectively detain and search her quite intimately just to check she wasn't carrying any diseases. It's like stop and search for the 19th century. Again, hugely sort of problematic from that sort of point of view. We have this line here, the great social evil, Time Midnight, as a sketch in Punch magazine, a sketch not 100 miles from the Haymarket. Bella speaking to one person, "Oh, Fanny, how long have you been gay?" You know, the whole range is sort of shifting again, the ultimate routine. People couldn't talk about their sexuality. Homosexuality would shortly be declared illegal. Lesbian approaches, according to Queen Victoria, we couldn't even conceive of such depravity. So again, a whole range of issues relating to elements within that. And meanwhile, Josephine Butler is campaigning for women's rights to begin to raise the profile and actually say, look, we need to actually address these kind of issues. And so we come to new journalism. And a gentleman who we will mention many a time in seminars and indeed in this lecture today, W.T. Stead. Now, if I actually asked you, who in this image was W.T. Stead? I don't think many people would actually say that person. No, of course, it was this chap at the top. A typical image, a typical photograph of the ultimate ideal, quote-unquote, Victorian family, with the father at the head, the patriarch at the head, replete with beard, even before Movember. And obviously his fairly large family, dutiful wife, and offspring gathered around him in a wonderful sort of pose, strike, etc. Stead actually believed very earnestly in the power of the press, and actually argued many a time for journalists to become even more campaigning. He was very much a proponent of a new style of journalism, which really emerged from the 1850s onwards. We'd looked at some of the other key areas so far in things like broadsides, tabloids, provincial press, and so on. But this was a journalism which focused on the facts, and it focused on crime, sexual violence, some oddities, and thrills. It was a journalism form that originally started in America and then effectively devolved and changed and adjusted and was adopted pretty solidly by press people such as Stead in the 1850s onwards. Campaigning journalism was not necessarily designed to actually offer incisive political comment. This wasn't the sort of view of the Peterloo Massacre for the 19th century. It didn't really necessarily matter about how accurate the facts were that were being reported. But what it was very concerned about was the moral high ground and campaigning. And also, in addition to that, it was designed to be commercial and to make a profit. Who was the target audience? Question I've often put in terms of seminars. Well, the audience was primarily higher working and lower middle classes. So it's looking at the top end of the working class, people who obviously were literate, had sufficient money to actually read, and might be sort of wanting to move into the middle class, and the lower middle classes as well, a particular growth area. Its key characteristics were simplicity, a lack of padding, and in general, shorter sentences. It didn't have the level of flowery verse and prose that we've looked at in previous examples. Primarily, it started with the Sunday newspapers, Sunday Times and so on, but then developed into areas such as Lloyd's Weekly, the Pall Mall Gazette, and of course the News of the World, which was again the highlight up until relatively recently of the scandal sheets. By the 1860s, all of these press agencies were becoming more and more powerful. They were using power to stir up public opinion. And again, this worked through those six steps. How do you create moral panic? Didn't really matter in terms of how irresponsible that could be deemed as, how ethical it was. If you could actually transmit a news story to the middle class about the poor, that's probably the only time middle class folk would actually ever encounter the poor. If you exaggerate and distort those stories and present instances of crime being a plague on society and the poor as being dangerous, if you repeat a story often enough, as Lenin said, people start to believe it, simply through the power of repetition. Example, the London garrotting panics of 1856 and 1862. There were a number of street muggings that actually occurred in London in both 1856 and 1862. These were presented as being endemic to the capital. The Times actually campaigned between October and December 1856 with 7 editorials and 31 letters to say that flogging should be brought back and capital punishment was essential because otherwise these garrottings would carry out and people would continue to be strangled and mugged throughout the streets of London day in, day out. Curiously, when we look at some of the 31 letters who were submitted, several of them actually looked like fakes. Journalists were not beyond actually making up letters from people who were supposedly reading their newspaper and passing them off as fact. Shocking. Campaigns, also critical in terms of how we're developing this. And W.T. Stead's first campaign was for Gordon of Khartoum. He was actually retired by the British Army, General Gordon, on the grounds of being unfit for health. We now believe he was actually suffering some severe psychological anxiety. He was actually hearing voices from a range of folk that he claimed actually were giving him a divine mission in life and so on. But because he was a popular figure and had actually helped the British Empire in India, Stead campaigned actively against the government to send General Gordon back to Khartoum to look after the whole range of troubles that were actually setting up there. Result, massacre. He didn't have a clue. The government had done something that exceeded to what W.T. Stead had talked about, and had put somebody in place who clearly wasn't suitable for the post. Was Stead mollified by that? No. He moved on to connect with William and Catherine Booth. It's collectively known as the founders of the Salvation Army. And what Stead was actually looking to do with both William and Catherine Booth was to establish their assistance in developing a new purity campaign against prostitutes, and in particular against child prostitutes. Stead sent out a large number of his reporters and journals looking for examples and evidence of child prostitution in the cities and towns of London. They couldn't find any. What do you do then? Make it up? Yes. Eliza Armstrong, who was 13 at the time, was paid £5 to effectively claim that she'd been raped. And then she was sent off to France, inevitably with rallies, petitions, outrage and so on, and what effectively became known as in 1885 as £5 being the asking price for a maiden's tribute. Eliza Armstrong and her parents actually made some quite good money out of that. Stead, in this instance, actually ended up in prison for fabricating evidence and causing all sorts of problems and so on. But by that stage, the proverbial cat had been let out of the bag, the box had been opened by Pandora, and social purity groups, vigilante committees, and the moral majority were very much to the fore. Now, it's worth noting out that there isn't any association between the Salvation Army and Stead, because they were at pains to kind of distance themselves from each other. But it does go to show one of the strategies that's often adopted by people who wish to use rhetoric in journalistic terms to campaign for a cause. If you get key supporters, it can tip the balance. It's probably what Trump is thinking with respect to Nigel Farage, because obviously we believe everything Nigel would say. Nevertheless, you still have this whole sort of sequence whereby Stead has started this whole system out, opened up a scenario where possibly copycat issues were taking place, and ultimately you can then start campaigning by saying that the police are hopeless. You could even have a case of blind man's buff there, where in essence, you know, in the police gazette, or rather this is a case from an example of Punch, if you went to London, you were doomed to be a victim of crime and all sorts of other areas. There are other aspects that are coming across in terms of this new style of journalism. And let's go back to the conditions of the poor. On the 13th of November 1887, there was a gathering of the unemployed and vagrants who camped out in Trafalgar Square. Charities would actually supply food to these folk and unfortunates. Sir Charles Warren, on the other hand, was determined to clear the scum out of the city. So again, in terms of seeing these mass protests, Occupy movement and so on, there are concerns. Now, what's happening culturally within Britain at that time? Well, it is a period of mass migration. Why are more people emigrating and migrating to different countries? Well, you have famine in Ireland, the potato famine. You have agricultural failures. You have soil erosion. You have taxes in different countries, you have increasing demographics, and inevitably the British middle classes are becoming increasingly worried. Again, what do we see evidenced in the press at this particular time, in certain examples of the press, such as the Pall Mall Gazette, such as the News of the World and so on? We're seeing stories in which immigrants are being characterised as immoral, as illiterate, as violent, and again, feeding into a fear of overcrowding and also bringers of disease, epidemics. And certainly in terms of nations and nationalities and races that were targeted, the Jews, the Italians, the Irish, the Hungarians all suffered this form of prejudice. You know, quite open, quite blatant. Maybe you think Polish people in Boston as well, similar sort of thing that rhetoric sort of comes through at present. In 1905, the Aliens Act was actually introduced, not to stop extraterrestrials landing, just in case you thought that was the case, but no, it was to stop the so-called alien invasion of Britain by Jews, Italians, and Chinese people. The East End at this particular time was also neglected. It was characterised as a sink of iniquity, and inevitably you've got the ideal conditions there, the perfect storm to create moral panic. There we have it. The six steps to develop the whole system. Identify group behaviour as a threat to everyone else. Problems that you might have with Italians or Chinese. They don't look like us, they don't speak like us, they don't even speak the same language as us. What's happening? Conditions are poor, people are being stolen from, there are thieves around, people are being mugged, people are being garrotted. Something has to be done. Force something to be done, establish the sort of key things that are actually there. You've also got the key ingredients for, unfortunately, slightly psychotic members to develop and grow as well. Like, for instance, Jack the Ripper. It's part of the Criminal Law Amendment Act and part of the evidence that a certain soul who claims to actually be in his signature there, Jack the Ripper. What's the background to this? Well, between the 31st of August and the 9th of November 1888, the Whitechapel murders occurred. Great TV series, well worth catching today. Five women were actually mutilated. Inevitably, this gets huge press coverage. There was a fear that this could lead to more riots, that it could lead to moral panic. There were issues to work here. What can you respond? You look almost for a short-term goal. And the solution initially was blame the Jews. Blame foreigners. Foreigners who are attacking the British people in their capital city to overthrow the empire. And then finally, blame the women. Because clearly, if you're in prostitution, well, the area needed to be cleaned up in any way, shape or form. What were the responses of this? What were the reactions? Well, threefold. First of all, Parliament did react. It actually raised the age of consent in 1895 by the Criminal Law Amendment Act to 16. Secondly, it increased police powers to prosecute brothel keepers and prostitutes. And thirdly, in 1895, homosexuality was made illegal. It remained illegal until the 1960s. Huge reaction, huge overreaction, but again generated through this whole notion of moral panic and so on. Major attacks by the popular press on music halls, on theatres, and obviously on pornography. Again, all areas that have been suppressed. Again, if you think, surely Britain's going psychotic at this stage, it's not unusual, it happens. This happened tragically to Germany in the 1930s as well, but that's a different issue. There was still this notion about the patriarchal society that women who would actually need income would possibly go into prostitution. Men, meanwhile, couldn't actually help their nature. And so effectively, they were blamed for effectively being attracted by women on the game and so on. And that also made it very difficult for respectable women who weren't prostitutes or were ordinary living, trying to live their lives, to go out. Because basically, if they were approached by a man, well, it's their own fault for working out, walking out and dressing as a woman. There's a letter that actually comes from the Police Gazette, which I shall read you, a suggestion to how Jack the Ripper could be captured by Thomas Blair, writing from Gripton in Dumfries. He writes, suggestion for capturing the murderer. Police to dress and act as women decoys. Note, the men would require to be fair actors and behave in the natural manner of women of that class. Further, they would require to be shadowed by help in an unobtrusive way, and the whole scheme would require to be kept absolutely secret. For once the press got a hint of it, farewell to any chance of success. This plan is based on the theory that the murderer solicits intercourse and that the woman accompanies him to a quiet spot where the crime is committed while in the act. So the men who undertook the duty of capturing him would require to have all their wits about him. Thomas Blair, Gripton, Dumfries. Whole range of issues generated by Jack the Ripper, mass murderer, convict. Again, in an era where obviously in terms of Arthur Conan Doyle writing about Sherlock Holmes, you know, people become amateur detectives and so on, but all addressing this whole notion of journalism, getting those stories out there and its impact. What we see here is really the importance of just getting to the stage of having responsibility. The notion of a press being responsible, or is it irresponsible? You know, responsible journalism, irresponsible journalism. Why is new journalism new? Is an area I want to sort of begin to close this particular sort of consideration about. Well, as I said, first and foremost, it was in the style of writing. Okay? It comprised of a writing style which was a lot simpler. It didn't have the complex questions of looking at the writings of Virgil or the Platonic Socratic elements, which required evidence of a classical education and so on. You could understand it on a very basic, visceral, gut level. Secondly, it did have an active creation or invention of public opinion. Public opinion doesn't just emerge. You know, people often say you get the press you deserve, you get the parliament you deserve, and so on. You know, it's a result of interviews, it's a result of general investigation and so on. But this bizarre notion of the moral majority, regularly trotted out over the last 10, 15, 20 years again, you know, what is right, what is appropriate, it's a very dangerous context to work with it. Because most of us want to be part of that majority. And if for whatever reason, be that religious belief, personal upbringing, or whatever, you feel you can't be, you're put in a slightly invidious position. Suddenly you become part of the minority, and human beings, what we are, we normally want some kind of tribal collective unity. If we're suddenly seen as the other, the outsider, not sure where we sit on that sort of level. You know, you could be a student, you could be seen as the wrong side of the person at that point, you could be seen as, you know, an academic, you could be seen as all sorts of other areas. It's very dangerous to start looking at that. However, it's great for the press, because you can already know what your demographic is. You want to target the upper middle class, the aspiring middle class. You want to talk about the people who effectively have had their experiences of, you know, life to the extent that, you know, they want to, you know, increase and develop their own sort of appreciation, growth, and so on. And inevitably, you want to sell papers. You want to get to the stage of that new readership, that growing readership. Remember, this is at a time where, in terms of entertainment, you've got the musical, you've got general jokes and scenarios that are actually taking place from that point of view. You've also got the whole range of the press, and that's it. You don't have film as such. You don't have radio. You know, this is where people are getting their news and experiences from. So that whole notion of where you're getting the sort of information from in a city, in an environment from that perspective, is the only game in town. Fourthly, style. We're also seeing photographs. We're seeing photographs to illustrate the key elements that are being shown. You know, photographs of murders, photographs of victims, drawings, crime, graphic illustration. Pornography is quite literally the writing of loose women, the writing of prostitutes and so on. That's the definition of it. When we start talking about the sort of pornographic imagery that comes across from that basis. And in terms of the content style, obviously you're going to use things like asterisk, asterisk, asterisk to actually blot out the more potentially offensive words, but you'll still ensure as far as possible that you can make your writing as salacious and juicy as possible to actually tap into that very growing marketplace of readers who ultimately want to have the salacious, the scandalous, the shocking. You know, at one level, it's a big market. You can approach it to a whole range of successes. Fifthly, the notion of campaigning. Whether it's for General Gordon of Khartoum, whether it's for a military campaign, whether it's saying we want war, what do we want? War, we want it now. Whether it's battling in for sort of other areas, whether it's simply a case of changing the law and adjusting legal activities, campaigning can create the news. You no longer simply report the news, you actually campaign to generate your own news headlines. Very useful strategy. It becomes almost a wonderful circle of itself, really. So, does that mean it's bad? Well, this is something we'll talk about in seminars. And again, it's at the heart of the primary news source that I give you for this particular fifth segment. Can we actually identify moral panic and generating moral panic as being irresponsible journalism? I'm not going to comment on that because I'm going to hand that over to your good self. But I will actually sort of address that final issue, which is it simply commercial? Does it really matter when WT stayed here? Interestingly enough, his subsequent scenario was he actually was one of the key passengers in the executive class of a certain ship that had its main voyage in 1912 called the Titanic. And still hasn't made a contact from beyond the grave, so we presume he's still actually sort of moved on to whichever heaven or hell editors and newspaper owners actually go to. But are we actually saying that what Stead was actually doing was simply reflecting the conditions of the time? Was he actually sort of putting something together which was guaranteed, pretty much in the stages that I've taken through today, to be a commercial success, you know, rather than something which was an objective, accurate delivery about the whole sort of system? In other words, was it setting commercialism above accuracy? I'll give you one more letter from the Jack the Ripper scenario. Again, this comes from Percy Lindley in Loughton, and it's worth considering in terms of some of the issues we've mentioned, and of course the panic that was being set in and the responses that was being made. Sir, I have seen your letter to the Times on the subject of bloodhounds, and perhaps you could answer a question I have put to many without a satisfactory reply. You might like to check this out at the back there, unless you're having your own little conversation for a moment, okay? Thank you. Supposing a hound to be brought up at once to a corpse after a murder, how is the hound to know what are the tracks or what is the scent of the murderer, or how is he to know that you want the particular track tracked? If the murderer left a portion of his clothing behind and some of his blood, I could understand a dog following up, or if you could show him a particular spot where he'd been standing. But on a London pavement, where people have been walking all the evening, there may be scores of scents almost as keen as those of the murderer. This seems to me that this initial difficulty is in need of a solution. Yours truly, C.W. Charles Warren. P.S. Would a hound follow up a person on whose hands was the blood of a murdered person if he is shown the blood on the ground? I scarcely think he could. Hopefully between now and seminars we won't murder anybody, or write about murdering anybody at that particular stage, or deal with any kind of people who are in any way, shape or involved with sort of prostitution or various other factors, but who knows? Thanks for your time. Make sure you've signed the register, and I'll see you in seminars.